In January, we rang in 2020 with the same optimism that we do every year. The sentiments we hear year after year of good health and success were spread amongst our networks. However, no one knew what was about to hit us. Like many fourth-year students, I was preparing to finish my undergraduate degree at Wilfrid Laurier University, excited for what the possibilities of the future held. However, instead of being met with potential opportunities, the world was met with a global pandemic that came into full effect in Canada by March. Hi, I'm Amelia Mola-Schmidt, and you're listening to In Conversation with Radio Laurier, a podcast where we talk to various professionals on the COVID-19 epidemic and how it is affecting our local communities and world.
One of the greatest challenges that has risen out of this pandemic has been the transition for students from in-person instruction to online. The use of Google Classrooms for instruction during the pandemic has been adopted by many school boards, specifically the Toronto District School Board. Now, this transition comes at a trying time for both students and teachers. If we remember, just before the pandemic, many teachers were striking and many children were out of school. Due to the proposition by the Ford government to increase online e-learning for students in high school, and also to increase class sizes from 22.9 students to about 25 to 28. Now, fortunately, Ford backed down from this at the beginning of March, and negotiations are set to continue. Joining us today on our program are two public school teachers within the Toronto District School Board, Catherine and Greg. They have both been teaching at the elementary level since the 1990s. Here's what they had to say. All right, so today on our program, we have Catherine and Greg joining us from the Toronto District School Board. Kathy is a grade 2-3 teacher, and Greg teaches kindergarten. Guys, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to see you, Millie.
Thanks so much.
So obviously, you guys have been teaching for many years. Can you describe the environment for public school teachers today, pre-pandemic? How have things changed since you guys initially started teaching in the Toronto District School Board system?
Oh, that's a big question.
Hilarious. I would say there's been a massive shift in there was a really good model that came out about 15 years ago where it was a triangle-based idea where the student, the teacher, and the family share responsibility for achievement. Mm-hmm. And communication was very important in that model.
Right.
I think now it's kind of shifted to a little more of the teacher and the student and less of the parents. And I think now with this new model of learning we're in now, that's gone dramatically back to a massive amount of responsibility on the family.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's especially true for the learning that I'm trying to encourage at home because 4 and 5 year olds, they need that sort of guidance because they're still developing literacy, numeracy skills, etc. And that's the kindergarten model. There's lots of one-on-one and small groups, and so the parent has to step in and kind of replace us in a sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are the most significant challenges that public school teachers are facing today? If you could point out one or two.
Overall, just fewer resources.
Mm-hmm.
Less money means fewer staff are there needed.
Right.
And other kinds of services and so on, to support learning, and especially children with needs who are in difficulty have longer wait times for special support.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if we're talking like pre-pandemic, absolutely the lack of spec ed is massive. It's the new model is inclusion, mm-hmm. which sounds amazing. It's this idea that everyone can succeed in a classroom with sort of more of universal design, so that what's designed is absolutely possible for everybody. And that's a great idea. The reality is a little different when you have a great number of children working at different levels. So the idea of teaching has really changed, and there's a great deal of design involved. So that's mm-hmm. not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the lack of support for children who need individualized support through the older grades is really dramatic. It's really hard to watch.
Right. I just want to go back to Greg quickly here. I know with kindergarten, Ford was proposing some changes. Right now, the current system is that there's a designated early childhood educator in the classroom. And that really supports children a lot, like with their learning and their numeracy skills, reading and writing. What would be, like, with the changes that he's proposing with limiting the teacher's role, what are the threats that that poses to learning in at the kindergarten level for the kids?
So right now, yes, I have a teaching partner. Mm-hmm. And we bring different training and different backgrounds to the classroom. And mm-hmm. it's a very strong model that way. Mm-hmm. I bring the point of view of knowing sort of where the students are heading as they, you know, start primary grades, grade 1, 2, 3 and beyond. So I can design a program based on what I know, I can anticipate where they're headed. And we would design activities, you know, her expertise is more on that sort of hands-on and play-based learning of younger children. Mm-hmm. So between the two of us, we can design a program that covers all those different areas. And I mean, whatever board would do to change that, to remove either of us or limit the presence or the influence of either of us, that just wouldn't provide everything that a young learner needs. Mm-hmm.
The idea is that the ECE in the room has more of a developmental approach.
Right.
And they take the child from where the child is, whereas the teacher in the room is meant to have more of an academic, just as Greg said, the context of where they're going by the beginning of grade one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Ford right now, because obviously he's been at the forefront of many of the issues facing public school teachers right now. Many critics of him are comparing his policy to the era of Mike Harris and common sense policy, and they're saying it's making a bit of a comeback 20 years later. So how are these times that we're in different for teachers with Doug Ford? Or are you guys seeing a lot of parallels between the Harris years of outcome-based learning and what Doug Ford is proposing for teachers?
Well, I was actually teaching in those years. Ha ha, that's how old I am. And it was devastating because there's so many changes that happened in the common sense revolution. The massive amalgamations of different boards of education into massive mega boards mm-hmm. was devastating for children and families, because we would do business on the phone with great efficiency. I'd see a child struggling. We would bring them quickly to team. I knew exactly the social worker they'd be working with. I knew that the psychometrist would be coming by. It was an incredibly efficient approach in a small board of education where you know who you're dealing with. In the mega board, when TDSB is an amalgamation of five large boards of education, it just became unwieldy, and a massive amount of movement between locations, geographies. Mm-hmm. That's one level. A second level was obviously the introduction of EQAO, the provincial assessments. That all started at that time. And it created this sense of value for certain schools that were achieving 100% in all three competencies, the reading, writing, and math. And it even drove, it's still driving, in fact, real estate values. So, for example, that's one of the pieces of data pulled up by especially the Fraser Institute. Mm-hmm. It became kind of punitive, like if you're in a grade 3, you're really nervous about that test. I'm in a grade 3 this year, and I mean, it still has an effect on you emotionally. Mm-hmm. You really wish that your kids could do well, even though it's just a test of where they're at. It's meant to be almost just a reflection of many years of schooling, but as a grade 3 or 6 teacher or 9 or 10, you really take that on. Finally, I think, the long answer, sorry. Finally, I think a great deal of the attitudes towards teachers changed at that time. Mm-hmm. So it went from kind of, I remember saying this very publicly, you probably remember it when you were younger, that teaching is a profession that, you know, used to be highly, highly respected, and perhaps too much so. I mean, we can all learn, we can all grow, but the amount of changes that happened from the top down in the common sense revolution was mind-blowing. A lot of parts of the job really changed, and the status of teachers seems to change. There were a lot of job actions since then.
Mm-hmm. To add to that, one of the big changes that came after, when I first started teaching, there was not a cap for primary classrooms, mm-hmm. and now grades 1 to 3, for about 15 or so years, the cap has been around 20 students and one adult, and that was demonstrated to be like important. If you have too many children, a teacher, there's only so much one teacher can do with mm-hmm. children of a certain age, especially. And so my first year of teaching, those caps weren't in place. So I was teaching a grade 1-2 class, and there were 30 children in the room.
Wow.
And anyway, so that was the tail end, I guess, of the mm-hmm. common sense revolution, which was, teachers can do more with less, and the education system doesn't deserve to be well funded. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to sort of think ahead and invest, look at education as an investment in our future, whatever, citizens. Mm-hmm. So now I think, coming back to what's happening now, they want to take away those caps, and every which way that they can, they're trying to force us to do more with less and force fewer teachers to do more work, mm-hmm. and save money that way.
Right. Now, I'm just wondering, going back to that triangle model that you guys talked about at the beginning, where it's parents, teachers, and children all involved together, did you see like a shift between when it was Harris and then the Liberals came in provincially? Was there a bit of a shift back to that model, or has it been consistently kind of strictly the teachers bearing a lot of the burden?
That's a great question. I think it totally went back to that model. I really heard that model in PD sessions about 15 years ago. So mm-hmm. that would have been a Liberal government at that time. Mm-hmm. A lot of what Harris seemed to be talking about, casting my mind back, was very, he wanted value for money, and he wanted it to be sort of provable from the teachers. So right. hence the accountability idea. So he had an incredible teacher evaluation that he brought in. It had like 116 competencies that you had to fill out. Wow. I actually did one. And it was like a thesis. It was great. So I can be preparing materials for children and evaluating them, or I can be looking at myself and how I can improve in these 116 competencies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very much in his day focused on like the teacher is responsible and not cutting it. So if there are factors at home that are causing there to be some challenges in learning, or if the child just needs extra help with their learning, no, that's on the teacher, and you better figure that out. Luckily, that has balanced out. I don't think anything's ever been that bad mm-hmm. Since. And in fact, I think things may, I'm now optimistic things may balance out again. Mm-hmm. Just because I think the parents are now really seeing right. in the current, like they're doing so much of the work at home right now with their kids, and they're seeing like, it's a lot. It's a lot to encourage a child to learn and work. And in these circumstances at home, I can't imagine mm-hmm. what they're going through. So I think there's going to be a swing back to a more balanced shared model.
That's excellent. Now, of course, teaching has changed drastically since we've all gone into lockdown. So what's a typical day in the life of teaching during the pandemic for both of you?
Okay, I'll go first. So I at the beginning of this, I'm myself with my teaching partners, we created a website with a series of pages with a series of activities. Mm-hmm. And we really had to stress, because everyone's worried about everyone's mental health, that yeah. this can't be a burden on you. Mm-hmm. That's the big number one message, certainly at the very beginning, where do what you can do or don't. And what our approach ended up being was to provide a whole lot of variety of choices of different kinds of activities that are easy to access on a website, where parents can choose things if they can work with their child, and things where, you know,
give an example, like sorting tasks.
Yeah, okay. Or there's like science experiments, which would be require the parents to assemble the kind of materials to do a simple task of, oh, do objects float or sink? And some, you know, anyway, we you're asking about a typical day. So kind of managing that, prepare the activities for a week and put it out there and publish it, and also email parents and stay in touch and do math emails like, oh, we got new activities up, and always encourage them to let us know, get in touch with us if they have questions, and we're constantly encouraging communication.
Yeah.
But also being cognizant of the fact that some parents, you know, they have big, big young families and their hands are full. And so accept that reality that, you know, the their participation may well be limited.
Right.
And support them in whatever they're able to do. Anyway, so answering emails, updating things, posting student work.
What do you do on Thursday and Friday?
Oh, that's so true.
I've heard there's a session with the cat.
I pop in too if I feel like it's getting. Anyway, sorry, we're jumping ahead.
No,
what do you do on Thursday?
So we do meetings like this with the children, and we've all learned how to sort of run and manage these meetings, and like two children and two teachers, and that seemed like a pretty good number. And we thought, maybe we can have three kids. And they have to learn all over again. Like when you're in a classroom with kids, you can use eye contact and body language to help them remember to take turns to speak and all of that. So we're limited when we're on screen, how much, you know, how much control we have over like a group conversation. But that's been the goal, is to try to encourage interactions that are somewhat like what we would have in the classroom, and give children a chance to speak and to share, and then interject with something that could be a new, whatever, a launch to a different conversation, or do a little game. I say games are like work really well. Even if a game is like, oh, what is this? What is this shape? Or what is this word? Or what is this letter? And in some ways that's a lot easier. But the important thing is for us to see the kids and vice versa. And so, like, I can't imagine what a 4 or 5 year old is thinking about all of this and how strange, and I don't want to say harmful, but it's got to be leaving some kind of impact. So we definitely knew from the start that we wanted to be checking in every week with the kids and try to talk to them, try to make, replicate some aspect of the classroom and the interaction in the classroom.
That's great. Anyway, Catherine, what's your experience been like?
Well, yeah, and just to add to what Greg said, he's actually seeing a huge percentage of his children live every week. So in terms of actual, that's something I don't think you touched on. So different configurations of his teaching team are hitting, would you say 90, 95%?
We get, in a class of 29 each week, we'll maybe get three that don't, for one reason or the other, don't participate.
That's really impressive.
90%.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Really, so he's able to assess and check on and visually just see that the kids are okay. They're learning, they're growing, they're thriving. And he's guiding their learning. They're reading a book together. He'll have the SKs reading that book. Anyway, sometimes it's hard to talk about your own practice because you're not even aware of all the things you're doing, but
all the amazing things, it sounds like, too.
Yeah, it's great to see them. Like, that's the one thing where we know what the participation is, like the level. Where we're actually seeing them, we're actually talking to them. And that's where it approaches normal or what's familiar. Whereas just putting out the activities, putting it out there, we then have no control over what gets done or how it gets done.
But the meeting is a massive part of the learning, just like the kindergarten model where the experience is together.
Yeah.
And you're replicating that in a really cool way.
Right.
So you should be happy.
Yeah, no, that's I'm very fantastic. Happy with that part of it that we've been able to do, and it's all whatever, create the routine and create the habit and be proactive, and you send families here's the link. We use Google Meet and they click on the link to join the meeting, and sometimes parents forget. So I've got my phone list standing by. So like, oh, here's our scheduled meeting. And oh, this person hasn't joined yet. So I'm quickly going to dial their number. And in a lot of cases they're like, oops, oh, thank you, I forgot. Or, oh, okay. Yeah. My child is finishing their nap. I'll get them up and get them in to join. For sure. So it is important. And we recognize that, and we do everything we can to bring everyone in.
Right.
And so we can see each other.
I'm curious to hear what the children's response has been. Like, are they vocal about missing the classroom? Or I know some kids, this has been like a, 2-month-long pajama party, but I'm sure most are missing the classroom. So have they been vocal to you and their friends about that, their classmates?
Sometimes we hear, we only do small groups because that's what's manageable. But some of them will say, oh, I'd like to see so-and-so. So we've actually encouraged that, they can request these certain kids. And so then the following week we'll change the configuration of the little groups of 2 or 3, so that kids can see each other. And some of them, for sure, I mean, they're all different, of course.
Yeah.
And then at home, children at home with their parents, just sort of out in the wings is different. And the children at school away from their parents. So they're taking prompts from mom and dad sometimes in our little meetings. Some of them have adapted very well to the format, where they're very capable of interacting with all the different streams and asking their friends questions, asking the teachers questions, really strong. Social skills, and other ones are more quiet, and some of them, they're very excited to show you something and in an unexpected way.
Yeah.
They'll sing or share a toy. So it's kind of an opportunity for them in a way. If they're shy at school, then maybe they have a little more confidence at home when they're surrounded by their parent is close by and there's things that they love, like objects at home that they can talk to us about.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's great to hear those little slivers of positivity.
Yeah.
So, sorry, Catherine, I interrupted you just as you were about to start explaining your experience and how your experience.
No way. I think it's really important to get that out of Greg because I think it's really working, and he can track differences in children over time. He's seeing etiquette being built up in terms of knowing how to be in a conversation with 6 people in a split screen. And
wow.
It's amazing. It's incredible. I drop by them just for fun, like a little drop in guest. And then I disappear again, but it's a lot of fun. And they're sweet. They're just amazing. So anyway, for me, I haven't been doing the face-to-face meetings, and there's a bit of controversy going on about this. Our education minister has indicated that synchronous learning is a model that he feels works best. I'm not sure he's really ascertained the level of technology that all of the participants have.
Yeah.
I know for me personally, getting devices to kids has been the number one challenge.
Right.
So in my class, that has been the biggest impediment to student success and participation, is they simply have nothing at home. Luckily, the PDSB was able to just mobilize its massive resources, and they've literally had teams go into schools and take all the technology out of schools. Unbelievable. And then wipe it, reconfigure it, and out and package it out to students and couriers. So I'd say maybe a third to half of my staff needed that service.
Wow.
Yeah, massive. I've created a Google Classroom platform for my class, the Straight Tree this year, and I'm just kind of working my way through the themes of the year and trying to make activities as exciting as possible. And I'm aware of my own boredom sometimes. Like, if it's boring. So I did a week that was just all about Gordon the cat, because they have heard these little asides before I start a lesson. I'll be like, oh, Gordon was brutal this morning. And they love those, you can imagine. And they love those stories. So I said, okay, we're going to do a week about the worst cat on the planet. And but to get them to interview a cat and do research on a cat and and apply that. Anything I can do to get them writing, reading, and expressing themselves with some fun.
That's fantastic.
That's it for me. I track it, but I don't evaluate it. This is a really important shift, and it's really going to be difficult to write report cards in a couple of weeks. We're just getting information rolled out about that, how those will look, and what we're expected to assess. I think it's totally unfair to assess anything that we haven't observe the child doing.
Right.
So when I'm assessing a child, I know how many tips I gave. I know how much support I gave. I know I kind of stopped them here and redirected them there. But at home, there are children that are working completely on their own. There are other children who have really amazing access to support. And it's not fair. It's not equal and it's not fair. And it creates a challenge in assessment, I think. I read one thing that said, oh, assessing this work is just assessing a child's access to technology.
Yeah, which is, I'm sure, unequal. And I want to get into that in a couple questions from now. But I just want to move quickly to the strikes that were going on before the pandemic happened and before schools shut down in-person instruction. So obviously there were significant strikes going on as a backlash to Ford's proposed increased class sizes and the idea of introducing more e-learning. So overall, how has the forced use of e-learning during the pandemic possibly showcased flaws and gaps it creates for students? Or has it been beneficial? Like, I know, Greg, you've had a fairly positive experience, but I'm sure overall there might be some things that are indicating that this may not be the way to go.
Well, we, you know, we've done this because it's what's necessary. And I feel like, you know, people are doing it in the spirit of, let's make the best of this situation. Let's use the resources that we can as well as we can. And I think teachers as a group are fantastic at improvising and being pragmatic and sensible about whatever the choices that they make about how to teach. So it showed teachers in that light as you know, as problem solvers. But it's nothing. Like, there's so much that's missing from this experience of being physically with people. And in kindergarten, it's all about, you know, it's about communication, beginning with oral language and you know, and social skills and all of that. And there's just so much that's not possible in, you know, through internet, online activities, all of that. And being outside is extremely important. Just being outside together, learning outside. So there's vast amounts of things that are just not possible. And like I said, I think it's just like making the best of a terrible situation. And I just want things to go back to the way they were.
I'm sure. I can only imagine.
I mean, just very quickly, what I find really frustrating is not knowing. So if I'm not, because I'm not meeting with kids the way Greg is, I'm just looking at emails back and forth, phone calls, and work samples. And children I'm not seeing a lot from, I wonder about, and I reach out and, you know, there are barriers. And I just feel like I just want to fly through the telephone and just drop it and help out and then disappear again. But, you know, it's tough. And it's ridiculous to ask this. It's a lot to ask the families. Like, we're really clear on that. This is an extraordinary circumstance. And a lot of parents are luckily able to work from home in some capacity, even if that means finishing their own education, their own school. And to ask them to, like, be teachers at the same time is really awkward.
Now, I know you mentioned earlier, you're saying that one third of your students, Catherine, had relied on the technology coming out from the TDSB to work, to be able to participate in learning from home. So how is this pandemic and e-learning impacting students who come from families who face internet insecurity more than others? And how is this affecting or deliberately leaving those students out?
That's a fantastic question. There was one family who really comes to mind right away, and they had a device initially that they borrowed from an aunt, and then it broke down. So they were after the first wave of the survey, so they knew they were going to be waiting a very, very long time, and they did, and they were really, really, really anxious about missing work. So I was emailing the choice boards from the language and math activities and the Google Classroom directly to them so they could track and follow at home with paper pencil and just photograph or document what they were doing. But I mean, all of that implies a level of motivation that's still in existence. One effect of this pandemic is, you know, some people aren't really feeling that motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing we do as teachers. Greg was talking about how important it is to be in person and to build energy. That's what you do as a teacher. You build excitement about the silliest thing. Today we're learning about verbs. Ah! You've just got to build it. And mm-hmm. if you're not there to do that with them, it's brutal.
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect of you know, the use of technology and the inequity is whether families are tech savvy. Even we have a website and add weekly activities, and it's pretty straightforward from my point of view. I try to make it as easy to use as possible, but I don't even know if you're not familiar with the site, how easy is it for you to navigate on a phone or a tablet as well?
In English.
Can you find?
Yeah. How's your English?
Yep. Can you find what I'm putting out there? And can you use it? Can you understand it? So there's language barriers that are interfering with. But again, there's the great unknown. Like, as Kathy said, we just don't know. If we're not hearing, we have, you know, we can make assumptions, we check in, we do what we can, and hope for the best, kind of, and know, again, that families are busy. If they're not, like, you know, some of them are essential workers, so they are continue to work.
Yeah.
And they have to make arrangements for their child, you know. If normally they have their shift, their work shift, while their child's at school, and families have, especially in kindergarten, you know, these are often families of other similarly aged siblings. So families could have 2, 3, 4 children under the age of 10.
Wow.
And that's a full day, just all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, so many things that we don't know.
Yeah, well, if anything, I feel like this pandemic and, you know, the e-learning that students and teachers have had to be using has shown that internet literacy, as you talked about, the ability to navigate the vast landscape, isn't as accessible for everybody. And of course, internet security is something that some are privileged to have, but many do not. So I think looking at this now, later on, after this pandemic happens, I'm hoping and I'm hopeful that people are turning away from the idea of e-learning for students, because there are significant gaps and significant amounts of students that get left out of this equation.
Well said. I mean, if you think about parts of Ontario where the bandwidth is really reduced because of geography,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just mystifying to me how this could possibly be equitable, right?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Good point.
Now, just to wrap up here, my final question. Of course, this is a difficult time for everybody, especially, as you guys have mentioned, for working parents whose children may require extra learning support. So what can parents be doing at home to support their children through the rest of the school term, which I'm assuming is going to continue online?
We've heard nothing. There's two questions there. We've heard nothing about a return to school. It could come, information comes very quickly. These changes you know, the announcements and as deadlines have been extended. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the number one thing that we need to focus on is the wellness of the child. It's so important that that the information the child is accessing, because there's so much time on the computer that is monitored, that they're not seeing upsetting images or getting frightened about images about the disease. Mm-hmm. And that families are able to talk to each other, like building in dinner time and just like clearing off the dining room table from all the projects, sit down and try to have dinner together and talk about how people are feeling. Super. I know it sounds sort of basic and corny, but continuing to talk and spend time together is so much more important than any e-learning that we could be doing.
Mm-hmm. So what can families be doing is your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, take care of themselves. Like you said, like focus on your own wellness and, you know, I'm not sure what to add. You said it all mm-hmm. very well.
I guess just overall creating a supportive learning environment for their child as much as possible. Because as you guys have both mentioned, some parents are working on the front line or have multiple children that they need to support through school during this time.
I mean, one other thing I might add is just we're still working from home, though we're still connected to a network mm-hmm. of other kinds of services. You know, the school normally we have regular meetings with experts from different fields to help support all the different learners that we have. And so that encourage parents, if they are struggling with something, to reach out to us as well. And we can direct them to whatever social work resources, other kinds of people that can help them if they are, you know, having a difficult time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fantastic piece to end off with. Catherine and Greg from the Toronto District School Board, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Miller.
And I hope you can get back to your kids in the classroom as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Millie.
In Conversation with Radio Laurier is written and produced by Amelia Mola-Schmidt. Our song that we use for the podcast is called Dub Eastern by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.